with political research specialist Mae Brussel.
To the Watergate news this week because it's so important.
We want to repeat that, maybe, because I think the orchestra,
the music,
the boys in the band were a little loud there.
Okay. I keep going back to the news of the Watergate Hotel because I know that people who just pick up this show are probably wondering, you know, we're jumping around a little bit today. I always want to get back to the Watergate because the culmination of all my research on political assassinations can be visualize if you follow the newspaper articles of what's happening at the trial or the cases that are going to come up there. Because even with a tight lid on all the information coming out, you get a peek at the espionage establishment, the way it operates. And in that article that I did on The Realist on Martha Mitchell and why she was kidnapped, I said that if you follow this, if you follow the case very closely, you get a real view of how two governments exist side by side. What I put in there was that the CIA is not new at altering the choice of candidates or presidents. Innocent people believe that the electors have a choice of candidates through primaries or direct voting. And the same CIA that killed Kennedy because he won the majority of votes eliminated opposition to Richard Nixon in every election since Kennedy's death. Murders, accidents, attempted murders through the use of hired killers, planted patsies, and news coverage concealed the crime. Then I went on to say two governments exist side by side, one visible and one invisible. As the power structure gets more arrogant and sure of itself, the invisible becomes more clear and overt. And if the truth were told about the Wallace shooting and Arthur Bremer, if it's told about them, and if the Watergate affair is exposed, just those two, you would see how the invisible government agents go about their daily business. And this is, I'm reading from The Realist right now, it says, if the Democratic Party has the courage, or if it is allowed to follow through with this suit, you will find the most fantastic duel in American political history. Now, I go to an article this week that was in the paper about the financing, which may seem complicated to a lot of people, but I outlined it and charted it.
It's easier to understand on paper than it is to hear it.
It is? Really?
I think when you've got it in front of you, it's hard enough seeing it in a newspaper article, but it's a little easier in a chart. But listening to it, it sounds like
complicated.
The Art Buchwald column.
Oh, really? Well,
that we read last week was funny because it went on and on and on and on. But this is deadly.
Well, if you take an article, what I mean by making diagrams, I make a linear connection of the subjects in the article and branch them out. And
well, let's see how well you can do by trying it over the radio and see whether people can follow. Maybe if they have a pencil and paper.
Okay, I'm taking.
If you're listening now, get out your pencil and paper. We'll have a quiz.
Yeah,
afterwards.
We've done this before. I did this with several things. I'm taking an article.
Multiple choice quiz following this, so take good notes.
Okay, San Jose Mercury.
No, you don't have to take the quiz.
No, I'm going to give the quiz.
You're going to give it.
You're going to take it when it's over.
Oh, brother.
Okay, there was a large article. Texan links stands with Mexico cash.
Do we put stands at the top of the page now?
Okay. We're going to go, and there's another Monterey Herald article that was report links Mexico money to Watergate bugging. Now, what we're going to do, we're going to try to describe how you finance a clandestine operation.
It's kind of a do-it-yourself thing, huh?
I maintain that.
Nobody takes you up on this and tries it out, see if it works.
Okay, let them get their pencil now.
Okay, pencil and paper ready. We're starting in A4.
Espionage agency finance. Okay? Okay, Bernard Barker, a member of the CIA, a conduit of funds for the Bay of Pigs operation, was arrested at the Watergate Hotel June 17th. That was the top of your chart.
We're working backwards.
We're going to go right and left.
Oh,
now, don't confuse this.
Okay.
Backwards, I'd be off the paper. Bernard Barker. He lives in Miami. He was arrested at the Watergate Hotel. He had $5,600 in his pocket at the time of consecutive $100 bills. That's why they could trace this other money. If he went without the cash, they wouldn't know where these men were funded from. But he had money. The same man who was carrying cash on him was the conduit of funds for the Bay of Pig operation in 1961. Now, Bernard Barker had a bank account in Miami Beach where he had a deposit of $89,000 and another deposit of $25,000 that we went into last week on the show from Andreas from Minneapolis, who got a bank charter right after he gave the money to
You're
Richard
confusing
Nixon.
The chart.
Okay. Now, in his bank in Miami, he had $89,000.
Okay.
Plus
$89,000 in the bank in Miami plus $25,000.
Okay. The $25,000 came from Andreas in Minneapolis, and $89,000 came from the committee to reelect Richard Nixon, and it came in the form, I'll show you how it got into the bank, but it originally came in four notes from Mexico. Now, that's Bernard Barker. He had the money in his bank.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
When he was caught with $89,000 from a Mexican bank to Miami, the first story was that he had clients, real estate clients, in Mexico City that he was working with, and it was a refund to those clients. When he was first arrested and the money was discovered, this was money from a real estate transaction.
Okay.
And he's in
because
real estate transactions.
Because it was pretty evident that it had come from Mexico, so
okay.
That was the cover story.
Bernard Barker also travels around Latin America doing real estate transactions and quotes with Howard Hunt, who was with the CIA 21 years. At the time, Hunt was doing real estate transactions in Honduras and Nicaragua with Barker. He was still CIA. Barker was CIA. Okay. Now, he has $89,000 in his bank in Miami. How did he get it? Well, the Pennzoil Corporation, a Mr. Liedtke, the president, said, I know of and approved of the complex plans of the transferred money. There was a sum of $700,000 that went from Texas to Mexico and back to Houston, Texas. And they did it. It was money raised for the Republican Committee, $700,000, that went from Houston, Texas.
To Mexico.
To Mexico.
And back.
Sent back. And they did it to make it appear that the money came from Mexico. It really came from Houston, but it was sent to Mexico to make it look like it came from Mexico. So that that Mexicans had donated this money and not people in the Southwest. Now, this is washing espionage money.
This was re-election money?
Yeah, well, let's...
Isn't it illegal for an alien,
a foreign alien,
to contribute money to a political campaign?
It's only illegal if you're caught.
Famous
okay.
First and last words.
If the Scotch tape weren't over the door at the Watergate Hotel, it wouldn't have been illegal because a lot of foreign money...
Okay, but I mean, there is a law in the books that says that... Yeah. Aliens, foreign aliens, can't contribute money to campaigns.
Well, Mr. Pappas of the Pappas Foundation comes over from Greece and tells Richard Nixon, you're to take Agnew as your vice president. Are aliens, he lives there all the time, just about are aliens choosing our vice presidents for us? I thought at the time that was bad, and I've been talking about it for 4 years.
Okay,
so the money...
But the money then must have, on the surface, come from Americans residing in Mexico.
No, Americans in Houston who sent it to Mexico, so it returned looking like it came from Mexico.
But it would have to have come from an American in Mexico to return looking like it came from it.
But except they didn't. It was still crisp. There was some consecutive money there, which later is described as CIA money. It's interesting if it came from contributions that they were in chronological order, all new dollars. You see, now we're going to, let's get off. A messenger arrived from Mexico City on April the 5th. April the 7th was the cutoff day decided by the attorney for the Nixon Committee, G. Gordon Liddy, that from after the 7th they'd have to announce where their money came from. But this money came on April the 5th to the Pennzoil office in Houston, Texas, and there was $100,000, $89,000 in checks, and $11,000 in $100 bills. $11,000 in $100 bills, $89,000 in check. And the office it came from was Emmanuel de Guerre, a Mexican attorney, who's the lawyer for the Houston, Texas oil company that heads the fundraising of Richard Nixon. So you've got the fundraiser at the oil company in Houston. Now, the man who delivered the money, the messenger from Mexico, said to the Houston office, I don't ask for a receipt for the money. That in the fundraising business, you never deal with receipts.
I thought he asked for it.
No.
And he was told that that you don't, they don't deal in receipts.
Oh, maybe that was it. There was no receipt. There was no verification. It
yeah,
was
I think
made
he wanted one, but he ended up leaving without one.
Okay, it was made clear either way that he gave $89,000 plus $11,000 and no receipt. Yeah, this checks and cash. I did get a receipt. Now, they took this money and they picked up $600,000 more in checks and securities that they collected around the Southwest. And they rushed it to Washington, D.C. in their own airplane. They had $150,000 in cash and $500,000 in checks and stocks that went within 36 hours before the law clamped down to Washington, D.C., raised by donors in the Southwest that were supposed to be for Richard Nixon, gathered by the executive Pennzoil Company, and it goes to Washington, and it's handed to Hugh Sloan Jr. at the Committee to Reelect Richard Nixon. Now, when Hugh Sloan was called in for questioning, he had left the committee already. He left that committee as treasurer because his wife was pregnant, remember? And so Hugh Sloan was to have received that money, and $350,000 of this money, of the cash, which is quite a large amount, $350,000 out of the $700,000, was found in the safe of Maurice Stantz, who's the former Secretary of Commerce, well-known lawyer on the East Coast, who also received the money from Andreas from Minneapolis to Miami and back up to the committee. Stantz received this money. He's the man who's suing Larry O'Brien, you know, for hassling him, and says the banking committee didn't talk courteously to him. Maurice Stantz, in his own personal safe, had $350,000 that wasn't listed in the committee to reelect Richard Nixon as campaign donations. This is, I hope people will get the article in the Realist that I wrote. If you don't have it already, get the one. It's out of the Thunderbird. The ones who have it can appreciate the news coming in each day. If they've read it, they can appreciate the news, because $350,000 ended up in Stan's account, and now $89,000 ended up in Miami in Bernard Berker's account, and he's to be arrested. And the money that he has when he's arrested is consecutively numbered that matches the money in Miami that matches the money that was brought in, all consecutively. So it had to be printed by the CIA, because down in Miami they were talking about how the CIA operates with those clean numerical $100 bills. And if it was raised by you know, all over the Southwest, it wouldn't have that same appearance. It would be hard to find those all in order. So then Maurice Stantz had destroyed, or is supposed to have destroyed in his office, all record of transactions. Now, anyone who has heard Dialogue Conspiracy knows that many times we talk about one part of the conspiratorial process is the destruction of the evidence. We start with John Kennedy's car, the day he was killed, the lamppost, the street sign, the clothing of John Conley that can't, it was dry cleaned and laundered, and the State Department papers of Oswald that were burned by thermofaxing, and postal slips that disappeared. The evidence that hangs around that's loose is destroyed. Maurice Stantz's record of how he spent this money or doled it out is missing, and he promised, or somebody said, you won't find it. Now, there's several points about this money. One is that there is a violation of the law if Mexico financed this operation. See?
Or Mexicans.
The Mexicans, yeah. But imagine if Americans in Houston are found with consecutive money that they send to Mexico, then send it back on a plane from Mexico, put in a bag, sent to Washington, ends up in Miami, and it's financing espionage clandestine activities in Washington, D.C. So there is a violation of the law. The second thing is that this is clandestine money. It's cash. It's kept cash. Stantz doesn't deposit it with the regular committee. They move in cash, and it's useful to go about your business. Now, people say, how do you get away with financing James Earl Ray, Sirhan, Lee Harvey Oswald?
Where did the money come from? There must be a record somewhere.
There must be a record somewhere. The Warren Commission was very fanatical, and they almost told you how much toothpaste Lee Harvey Oswald used per month. I mean, they had such an exacting account of at the Coca-Cola Hostess Cupcake or something. They went really into depth. And then when I read the Warren Commission hearings, I found that Oswald was spending a lot more money and had a lot more hobbies and did a lot more things than they were talking about. But they thought if they could account for every cent, then he couldn't be an agent, because here's what he earned and here's what he spent. You see, and all his other cash, James Earl Ray went through all kinds of money, and Jack Ruby had money before he died. A lot of money goes into playing a conspiracy, but it shows up in this, in our time right now, this week, you know, and we can take advantage of the news and my research and go over it together and watch how an agency operates and also defends itself in the news media. So you have this, you have a violation of the law of the money from Mexico. You have clandestine money, cash locked up in safes. You have consecutive CIA money, and that is an important thing, you know. And then you have the allegation of Lewis Tacklin, which briefly I have to go in where he said that the San Diego conventions would be disrupted with violence, and he was to hire the radicals, and then the convention was moved from San Diego to Miami. And all of this money transaction is the interim of March, April, and May, after the ITT scandal and the funding of Nixon's campaign broke. When they moved and they moved the operation, so all the people, see, they were caught now because they had a new team working. They only had a couple of months to do it before that date clamped down for the money. You see? So all this money transaction all took place.
That explains, that might explain why the people who were instrumental in picking the date for the deadline suddenly found that they were barely able to meet the deadline for revealing what money, getting their money in before they would have to reveal the sources.
Exactly. And then they had to be careful, because if they broke the deadline or went over, they had to move it around a few times, you see, and lose its source. That's right. That's exactly what happened. That they had to lose. They were caught because the date they decided to move almost coincided with the date that they'd have to disclose the donors from then on. And if you are hiring a man in October and November, for provocations are going to take place the following summer in San Diego, and you're moving the whole group to the East Coast, you only have a short time to get the money out. You see, Mrs. Barker, Bernard Barker's wife, said, I don't know why he's back in this kind of a business. He hasn't seen the group of anti-Castro Cubans for 5 years. So there was this frantic gathering the money and losing the traces of the money, because the date, cutoff date, was the 7th.
But if they apparently had, it wasn't lost too well, huh?
No. Now, there was a problem here, a conflict of interest, which I think I wanted to bring up, because they're trying, the judge that's trying this case in Washington, D.C., the Watergate case, U.S. District Judge Charles Ritchie, is a man appointed by Spiro Agnew. Definite conflict of interest, because every one of the persons arrested belongs to the pro-Agnew as against the Nixon team. And I don't want to go too much into that right now, but the George ordered a case depositions to be stopped until September the 20th. And he said that newspapers were violating rules concerning pretrial publicity. And he denounced news conferences of the New York Times and Bernard Barker, various news conferences. And he said he didn't want any more news conferences on this thing. They carried on in the court and they shouldn't get so much publicity. Well, right after he said that, after the judge said he didn't want this, which was on the 13th, then Jack Anderson came out and got a news leak. And Jack Anderson spilled the beans. The Wright Patman and the Senate, the Congress was investigating this Texas money that had been washed and turned around so many times in Mexico, and they have a large document, 58-page report, on banking laws that was turned into the House Banking Committee. But Jack Anderson got a hold of a copy of it, and the report was not to be circulated. Chairman Wright Patman, Democrat of Texas, said no one was to circulate this because of the legal cases going on. And Jack Anderson got a copy and circulated to the Associated Press. Well, Jack Anderson's close friend, Frank Sturgis, was arrested at the Watergate Hotel. And he went down to the court the night that they were arrested and vouched for him and knew him for 20 years, and he was a source of information to Jack Anderson to write his column. Now, Jack Anderson has a buddy who's arrested. And the judges said, I'll have a mistrial if we get any more interviews or newspaper things on this case. Jack Anderson gets a hold of the memo and writes it, which would give his buddy a mistrial. I don't think it's fair for Jack Anderson to blow the case for a man who's fed him material for 20 years. To stand there and blow it, and I talked to people in San Francisco who were calling the Washington, the government headquarters today, and said, get on this in a hurry, and call the judge and tell him, what are you going to do with Jack Anderson? We didn't do it, and that man has a direct interest, a financial interest, because the guy feeds him information. So the friend of Jack Anderson that I'm talking about, Frank Sturgis, is written up as a part of a militant group that was apprehended at the time that John Kennedy was killed. His name was Frank Angelo Fiorino, alias Edward Hamilton, involved in the Bay of Pigs, a former Marine, a friend of Jack Anderson's, described in Computer Automation, an anti-Castro Cuban organizer in Miami. And he works with Diaz Lance out of Cuba, a former Castro Air Force chief. He purchased arms for anti-Castro Cuban groups. He was questioned by the FBI about Lee Harvey Oswald being in Miami in 63, as were his other friends from the No Name Key Group. Now, the No Name Key Group is what Jim Garrison refers to in his research and work. They're a group of men that decide to assassinate President Kennedy. This is written in Computer Automation, August 1972. If some of you want to go to the library, MPC, or Navy Postgrad, look this up. But I'm mentioning just Frank Sturgis in conjunction, who he is in conjunction with Jack Anderson, because Anderson could blow the trial and get all the men off. And one of the five men is down in Miami saying, we're not going to have a trial. This was in the Village Voice this week, we're not going to have a trial. So Frank Sturgis was part of the No Name Group off Lake Pontchartrain near New Orleans. And this group were training men with CIA backers, and they decided to kill President Kennedy. Clay Shaw, David Ferry, Major L.M. Bloomfield, Jim Braden, Guy Bannister, and other people the CIA involved, William Seymour, alias Leon Oswald, and so forth. The assassination group was well organized, backed from money from the CIA, had money from Texas right-wing groups. And the planning was complex and detailed and required a concentrated effort. And they were to set up Oswald, their decoy, as the patsy. Now, I'm reading, Computer Automation, August 1972. This is Frank Sturgis. One of the five men that's arrested is walking around saying, we're not going to have a trial. The judge in Washington is saying, I think I'll call a civil trial off. The federal trial isn't going to be anything. The investigator from the Justice Department said 2 days ago, we've already completed our investigation, and all this stuff is coming in about Mexico and Martha Mitchell. They're going to do an investigation, the Justice Department, of the Watergate, like they did the Arthur Bremer. I knew it. That's when I wrote my article in July. I knew the Justice Department would never investigate the Watergate, because their agents are involved, and they're there to put the lid on conspiracies and to plan them. They're not there to find them. That's why I wrote about it, the Justice Department. So there is Jack Anderson tampering with something in Washington that could be really serious. And I want to just conclude. We've got about 3 more minutes, and every week I want to talk about the death penalty, because McCabe had an article in the Chronicle this week about Emil Younger and Ronald Reagan. The elections in November, every week, spread word out about the ballot, Proposition 17, the death penalty, vote no. McCabe had a column about the dreadful and inhuman charade of capital punishment up in San Quentin. And he says, Governor Reagan and Attorney General Younger have their way. They will lead the public to approve the death penalty and restore it. He also said that Attorney General Younger and Governor Reagan and are self-proclaimed friends of the victim, friends of the gas chamber. McCabe said, I can only believe that Mr. Reagan is so anxious to be elected president of the United States in 76, and Mr. Younger so badly wants to be our next governor that they are willing cold-bloodedly to get the voters to believe that you'll control violence if you vote about this death penalty. It's a shame. It said this is Reagan's shame and Younger's shame, and it must be California's shame. And McCabe gave illustrations of where the death penalty helps people do murders. He gave 5 examples of people who wanted to die and committed the crime so that the state would take care of them. And I have a list of patsies that are political patsies up at San Quentin, like Charles Manson, John Frazier, Sirhan Sirhan, Hugo Pinnell, and four men on death row. The attack would frame as while he works for the LAPD to get them up on death row. So every week I want to say work hard and make the point, not only is it cruel and inhuman, but the two men who are defendants, well, Younger is a defendant, they sued for hiding the truth about who killed Robert Kennedy, and he wants Sirhan to get the death penalty. That's been changed now recently. It was commuted that he couldn't get the death penalty. But one of the big problems is if you get your political patsies in jail and quickly say all the evidence leads that they did it, you could kill them and never get the truth, like you killed Lee Harvey Oswald in jail. The death penalty is a treacherous thing, and call attention to it and tell your friend, if you listen to Dialogue Conspiracy, that innocent men are taking the rap for the real assassins. And they should, everyone should be allowed to live, but the men who have some foreknowledge of this assassination are covering it up, want the death penalty.
I think before we leave that I should mention that we're obligated under FCC regulations to offer equal time for the yes on 17. So if anybody's listening and feels that they have, their position has been weakened by May's arguments against the death penalty initiative, please contact the station and we'll try and arrange some equal time for you to express your viewpoints.
Okay, let's say the whole program was on the death penalty. They get 2 minutes, because that's all I did. They don't get the whole hour, right?
Okay.
Okay.
It's number 78 in an ongoing series of Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel. This has been...